Index options have continued to grow in popularity, potentially because they're easy to use, available in high liquid markets, have favorable tax treatment in some cases, and offer a simple settlement process. Therefore, we've dedicated an entire show to helping you understand what index options are, how they work, how they're different from equity options, and what you need to be aware of if you decide to start trading them in your portfolio.
You're listening to the Option Alpha podcast from OptionAlpha.com, where we show you how to make smarter trades, learn how the stock market really works, and generate consistent monthly income. Now, your host and head trader at OptionAlpha.com, Kirk Duplessis.
All right, hey everyone, this is Kirk here again from OptionAlpha.com, working every single week to make this the most popular investing podcast offered online because it's based on one thing and one thing only, and that's helping you consistently play smarter, more profitable trades. So again, thank you so much for tuning in today. On today's show, number 177, we are going to cover the Trader's Guide to Index Options. Basically, this should be your resource moving forward to understand what index options are, how they work, why they're different from equity options, and everything that you need to know potentially around trading index options. And like we said in the intro, index options have really grown in popularity, and I think they will continue to grow in popularity. But that doesn't mean that we have to trade only index products or that we should start trading away from ETF products in the future or stock products. You just need to understand how index options work and how they're different from what you are used to trading on the equity side. So first things first, let's dive into a little bit of an understanding of just exactly what index options are. So rather than an equity option, which is an option on a underlying position like a stock or an ETF, those are generally considered equity options. You have this other class of option securities, which are index options. And the reason that they're different is because they're tied to a physical index. And that physical index doesn't have any underlying stock or equity component to it. So most of the time, these are on big name indexes like the Dow Jones 30, which the ticker symbol for that is DJX, or the NASDAQ 100, again, ticker symbol NDX, the S&P 500, the SPX, which is one of the biggest products that trades out there right now in the index option space. And then you also have the Russell 2000, which is ticker symbol RUT. Now, all of these index options are option contracts based on the underlying index. And because the index can't be physically traded, you can't go out and buy the S&P 500, that means that these contracts act a little bit different than a equity option. And in an equity option scenario, you could actually convert the option contract over from the option position into an underlying position in the equity. And this doesn't necessarily have to always be stock. It can also be an ETF. So if you're trading an ETF like SPY, which is an actual tradable security, and you can buy SPY just like you buy stock in Amazon or Microsoft or Apple, then trading options on SPY means that you're trading options on an equity security, which can be converted from an option position to the underlying equity, in this case, SPY. So the main difference between index options and equity options is the availability of the underlying security. Index options have no underlying security which you can hold. You can't be long the S&P 500. You can't be short the NASDAQ 100. You can't be long the Russell 2000. They are indexes. They are trading benchmarks, but you can trade options on them. And that's the real difference, the big difference, I would say, right out of the gate between index options and equity options. Now, one of the other major differences that you find with index options is basically they are single transaction, massive exposure. And for a lot of institutions or for individuals who want that type of exposure in their portfolio, it gives them an easier way to get a lot of exposure through a single series of transactions. And so in the case of something like SPY, which is the ETF that's based off of the S&P, and SPX, which is the index option product that is also based off of the S&P, you have varying degrees of contract sizes. And so right now at the time that I'm recording this podcast, the S&P is at about 277 on the SPY contracts, and the SPX is at 2775. And so obviously they're very similar to where they're trading and they track very, very closely together. But if you were to go out and buy a long call option at the money on SPY, which is the equity option that you could buy, that would cost you about $1,300. To go out and buy the same relative strike on the SPX, which is the index option, at the money strike on the call side, it would cost you about $13,000. Now, in this case, they both are generally going to perform and behave the same, except for the fact that the SPX option is 10 times larger than the SPY contract. And so if you are an institution or a large high net worth trader or somebody who wants that type of exposure, with a single transaction in SPX, you can get massive exposure versus having to do 10 times the amount of contracts and get all those contracts filled, potentially pay all those little additional commissions if your broker still charges commissions, compared to the SPX. Now, it doesn't mean, again, that one is better or worse than the other. It's just one has different exposure. The SPX and all of these index option products typically are larger, more massive exposure relative to their underlying counterparts. And when I talk about the underlying counterparts, what I'm talking about is the equity index options that a lot of people do trade. And if they trade those, it's probably because they either don't want to trade the larger index option products or they don't have the capital to trade those larger products. So all of the index options that we mentioned here as examples, they do have smaller equity option counterparts. So DJX, which is the Dow Jones, has the DIA. The NASDAQ NDX has the QQQ. The S&P 500 SPX has SPY. The Russell 2000, the RUT index option, has the equity option counterpart of IWM. So what is cool about this is that you can actually pick your poison, if you will. You can choose to trade the larger product. You can choose to trade the smaller equity product. And they each have their own benefits and drawbacks, potentially for different investors. So let's get into the next question here, which is, what are those differences between equity options and index options that are beyond just the fact that they're based on indexes? And one of the major differences between them is in how they settle. So we alluded to this earlier, but because index options don't actually have an underlying security that they can be converted to, it essentially forces by default that these index options are going to be settled in what's referred to as cash settlement style or European style. And the idea around cash settlement is, well, they can't settle at the end of their expiration cycle to the actual physical shares of the underlying index, because there are no shares. You can't go out and buy the S&P 500 index. And so if you're trading SPX contracts, and let's say you have a contract that expires in the money, well, you can't convert that contract over to SPX shares. There are no SPX shares. If you were trading the equity counterpart to SPX, which is SPY, there are physically shares of SPY that you can trade. So at settlement, equity options get converted into physical settlement of the shares, the underlying equity position. But with an index option, they go through what's called cash settlement. And so all that happens at cash settlement is you take the value of that contract at expiration, and that money, cash, is exchanged in your account for the option contract. So if your option contract at expiration is worth $1,000, once you go through the settlement process, you now no longer have a contract worth $1,000. You have $1,000 of cash that is settled in your account. The same thing happens in reverse if you have a losing position. If at expiration with an index option, you are down $1,000 the day that it expires, well, now you don't just have an option contract that's down $1,000. You get that contract removed out of your account, and they physically take the $1,000 that you were down, and they settle and square up everything in cash. Now, a lot of people really like this European-style cash settlement because it makes things really easy at expiration, because you also don't have to worry about early assignment risk. I mean, what's going to happen on an index option if it goes in the money before expiration? Nothing. It just stays in the money because it can't be converted early into the underlying equity position. Now, does that make it easier to manage? Of course. But in order to do that, you had to have traded a much larger product to begin with. And remember how I said the SPX option is $13,000. The SPY contract is $1,300. So there's no free lunch here to say, oh, we get all these benefits potentially for no additional risk. Now, we'll talk about here at the end a little new contract that the CBOE did roll out. And I think it's kind of cool because it kind of tries to be the medium of both of these things. But for right now, we need to keep our discussion to the larger products and then the smaller equity counterparts. But this cash settlement thing is really cool. It doesn't mean that it's not going to be a good strategy. It doesn't mean that the options are going to work better. It just means it's easier to manage these at expiration. Now, the other major difference between index options and equity options, besides the fact that the underlying is non-existent with indexes, and the cash settlement is that index options don't pay dividends. Now, again, this is a little thing, but it can become a major source of pain for a lot of traders. I know that when we trade options here at Option Alpha, we do a lot of options trading on ETFs, and many times those ETFs pay dividends. And so every couple quarters, as we go through the dividend process, we have to make adjustments and we have to close or roll positions early because of dividend assignment risk. To me, it's just part of the business of doing this, but it is a pain for sure. It's something that you also have to manage in your account. And so if I were just strictly trading index options, I wouldn't have to worry about the payment of dividends because, again, there's no underlying equity. I'm not holding long stock in the S&P 500 and then looking to collect the dividend payment. Therefore, the option contracts don't have to worry about this dividend assignment risk and early exercising because there's nothing to exercise anyway. It's all cash settled at the end of the expiration cycle. So the simplicity of index options clearly is there. They are uber simple to use. They cash settle, which makes no risk of assignment, no worries of assignment if you're deep in the money on a contract before expiration, and you don't have to worry about the dividends. So there's a lot of good things that can be said about index options. Again, the major drawback continues to be the size, right? The size is always the really hard thing that a lot of traders have to overcome when it comes to trading index options. Now, the final area that we're going to topic with regard to index options is with regard to taxes. And this, again, is another area where I see index options, of course, become more advantageous to investors if you can handle the size of trading those options. And that is when it comes to what's called Section 1256 of these index option contracts. And basically what happens is that with any index option contract, you have the ability to classify capital gains on a 60-40 split. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, okay, that sounds cool, but what does it actually mean? So with a regular equity option, when you have a capital gain and you have been holding that option for under a year, then you are subject to short-term capital gains tax, just like pretty much any other short-term gains that you would have in an investment. If you obviously are holding the contract for longer than a year in some cases, then you're subject to longer-term capital gains tax. And so as an equity option trader, which is mostly what we do, a lot of our trades are subject to the short-term capital gains tax. Again, it's a cost of doing business to me, and we can't avoid it, right? Death and taxes, we can't avoid these things. But when you are trading index options, you do get a little bit better preferential tax treatment. And in the case of index options, under Section 1256, you have the ability to split the gain as a 60-40 split. And what that means is that 60% of the gain that you have in an index option can be taxed as long-term capital gains tax, and only 40% has to be taxed as short-term capital gains tax. Now, this is irregardless of whether you hold the position for a day or 2 days or 3 months or 6 months. Any of these short-term gains that you have in an index option are given this preferential tax treatment, where most of the gains, even though you held them for under a year, are taxed 60% as long-term, 40% as short-term. And that can create quite a difference in your tax profile at the end of the year, and quite a difference in how much you owe in capital gains. The drawback to this continues to be, because as much as all these things are super, super good, which I agree with, the drawback continues to be, can you afford to trade these larger products? And this is, I think, an area where in the future, I see more regulation coming down the line, or I would hope that more regulation comes down the line to push more of this preferential tax treatment on regular equity options to help smaller investors. This tax treatment, to me, helps larger investors. And I don't think it's necessarily fair that it helps larger investors, but it is the world that we live in. And so, unfortunately, you don't get this preferential tax treatment unless you trade some of these larger products. Now, that being said, I alluded to this earlier, but when we had Kevin Davitt on the podcast just a couple shows ago, he had talked about the fact that the CBOE is rolling out this new product called XSP, and it's very similar to, and it's meant to be, the smaller brother of SPX. And XSP is an index style option, but it's priced very similar to SPY. So as they continue to roll this out and as it gains popularity and people like me talk about it and hopefully more people start trading it, I think it's going to be a viable product in the future that could be used in exchange or in place of the larger SPX contract. You get all the benefits of the underlying security being cash settled, not having to deal with dividends, the favorable tax treatment, but you don't have to go out and outlay all the capital that's required to trade a larger product like SPX. And so I think that this will be more of the standard that actually comes down the line in the future. And I would hope that it really kind of grows in popularity and it goes beyond just this one product. But that is one way where I think the industry is moving in the right direction, giving smaller investors, smaller retail traders like me and you, the ability to trade some of these better, more favorable products in smaller accounts without having to outlay so much capital for the big index products. All right, so as great as index options are, and as great as we've definitely made them sound, the very next question, or the logical question you should be asking at this point is, Kirk, why don't we just trade index options then? If everything is so wonderful and we don't have to go out and buy options on the SPX, we can do spreads, and so we can control our risk that way. And that's definitely true. You can do a lot of spreads and you can do spread trading just like you can do it on anything else. So the question is, well, why don't we just trade index options all the time? It just makes it easier. There's not the pain in the ASS feeling that you have with dealing with dividends and assignment risk and all these things. And I would generally say that makes logical sense, except for the fact that you are highly concentrated in one market, or even if you traded all of the index products that are mainly out there, DJX, NDX, SPX, RUT, even if you traded all of those products as well, you could make the argument that you're not really trading anything different, that you just have a basket of indexes in the US. And so the concentration risk in trading these index options is very real, and I think is underpriced by a lot of people who just strictly trade these index products. Now, to really drive home this point, what I want you to do is I want you to do a little outside homework. And we'll link to this in the show notes over at optionalpha.com/show177 just to kind of help you out. But I want you to look up a strategy called the YES strategy. And this came out through Citigroup, and they actually had a real legal nightmare around this strategy. And the YES strategy stands for Yield Enhancement Strategy. And I think that's actually really catchy and clever. So good job on their marketing department for putting out a strategy that was called the YES strategy, Yield Enhancement Strategy. But ultimately, the YES strategy was simply selling iron condors on the SPX. And so if you're listening to this podcast, you're thinking to yourself, well, why don't we just sell wide iron condors or credit spreads or whatever the case is on the SPX or any of these index options, because they're really favorable tax treatment, cash settled, don't have to worry about dividends, no real assignment risk, right? Why don't we just do that? Well, Citigroup did that with one of their portfolios, with one of their strategies called the YES strategy, and they did it for high net worth clients, and it absolutely crashed and burned. Now, I'm here to say, and I said this when this happened, when the news story was kind of breaking around this, I don't think that the strategy was the issue. I think wide iron condors, high probability option selling strategies are great. We like them. We tested them. They work really well. So statistically, they should work well. The problem was, is that they used it on one individual product. And that's a big enough problem in and of itself. So if you're trading 50% of your account on one index, and that index, I don't know, just happens to crash or go down 15% like it did in 2018, or go down 25, 30% like it just did in the beginning of 2020, then obviously you have a massive liability on your hands where your supposedly high probability position goes into a very real sequence of massive, massive losses. And so that was the first thing that they did wrong. They had the right strategy, iron condors. They had the wrong allocation to individual tickers. And in this case, all they did was SPX. They didn't do anything else. Now, the second thing that they did, which was kind of outside of it a little bit, but it's worth noting, is they had massive leverage. So in some cases, I read that they were leveraging up accounts 20 to 1, 50 to 1 in some cases. And so you have a situation where they're trying to enhance the yield of these positions by using a lot of leverage. And option contracts are leveraged anyway. And you get into a situation where leverage on top of leverage, and then one bad situation happens. And of course, it's going to blow up. I mean, it's like Murphy's Law. This thing was eventually going to blow up, just like option sellers was eventually going to blow up because they were overallocated in oil and gas, as we've noted before. So the idea around trading just index options seems on the outside rational and logical. And I get it. I understand why people push this a lot. But the reality and the practicality of trading one index product, Even if you trade the whole basket of the US, it would still all track pretty well together and highly correlated. The problem with that is that if you go through crash type scenarios or major drawdowns, you put your portfolio at severe limitations, to the point at which you may not be able to recover. And I would argue that many people who go through drawdowns of 40, 50% in their account are so scarred emotionally and mentally from trading that they just frankly give up and they quit, right? And so you don't want to put yourself in that scenario, which is why, as great as index options are, and as much as I want them to expand in popularity to other products and other areas, unfortunately, the pain that we have to go through in dealing with equity options is okay and tolerable so that we don't have the massive pain of going through a huge drawdown, being too targeted and highly allocated in one product or a series of products that all crash together. I mean, you literally need not look further than the last 2 months of the market where everything crashed together. And so if we had just one potential position in SPY and the market went down and we had 50% in our account that was allocated to that, we could easily lose half of our portfolio in the snap of a finger. And so a lot of people ask me all the time, Kirk, why don't just trade SPX and why not just trade RUT or NDX? And I would love to just trade those products. But unfortunately, the allocation risk in being highly specified in those areas is too great. And so I would rather trade something like EEM and GLD and TLT and XRT and XOP and XLU and all of these diversified other products, even though they have a little bit more pain in the butt, right? There's the pain in the ASS factor of having to manage them and deal with assignments and having to worry about when dividends are going to get paid. To me, that's manageable because that type of risk that I'm taking on that end, I can manage and work around, but I'm also, by taking on that risk, reducing the risk of a single asymmetric event knocking out my portfolio. And so to me, that is the main reason why we don't just trade index options. As great as they are, and I hope that they gain in popularity, and I think they will in the future, things like XSP from the CBOE, those are great products, and I hope that they continue to grow. But until that happens, we have to still trade, in my opinion, a lot of equity options on ETFs that give us a lot more diversification and uncorrelated asset risk. So hopefully this has been really helpful for you. If you did enjoy this, please let us know. As always, a review on iTunes or a rating on iTunes definitely helps us out, gets the show into the hands of other people who need it just like you. And as always, you can get access to today's show notes, transcript, links, resources that we talked about by heading over to optionalpha.com/show177.
And now our favorite part of the show, Trader Q&A, where we ask a question from one of our current members about options trading. Got a question you'd like to ask Kirk to answer live on the air? Just head on over to optionalpha.com/ask and hit the record button to leave a message. That's optionalpha.com/ask. And now, here's today's question.
Hi, Kirk. I've been trading for a couple of months and I love your podcast. I've been learning a lot from them and they keep me motivated to always learn more. I have a basic question. If option selling is the best strategy, and since we do not have such thing as free lunch in the market, how come option prices don't fall to make this opportunity go away? Thank you.
All right, so thank you so much for submitting the question here for the Trader Q&A segment. And just to clarify, I think your question is specifically addressing the idea that option selling has an edge with the implied volatility risk premium, actually something we covered in the last podcast episode, trying to understand implied volatility for option pricing. And essentially, this idea is that when options are priced, they're priced on the implied or expected volatility in the future. And they are overpriced when we actually look back historically at how far the stock moves compared to the implied volatility of the stock, or how far the actual volatility was compared to the implied volatility. And this edge is always present in the market long term. And so the question here is, if this edge is present and there's no free lunch, why doesn't market participants, or why don't market participants, arbitrage this edge away? If we know that it exists, then how can we still continue to capture it if it's a known edge in the market? And the answer to this question is actually very simple. And what I want people to think about here is what is actually being priced at the time that options are priced right now. And this implied volatility assumes two things that will never, ever go away. And the two assumptions are, they assume that we have to predict with perfect accuracy where prices will go in the future and at what magnitude prices will move. And those things, because they are always forward-looking, and because option prices can never look into the future, nor could me and you look into the future. And so if this ever changes and we do have the ability at some point to look 10 days into the future, then yeah, this edge is probably going to go away. But until that happens, until we could accurately look into the future and predict the future, we're never going to know where prices are going to move and to what magnitude prices are going to change as they move into the future and near expiration. So as much as the market assumes that all pricing is accurate right now, and it does, market pricing is accurate at the time that options are priced, but they are only priced making assumptions on how far the stock may or may not move into the future, or the implied expectation. And so the edge in option selling reveals itself or matures as you go through time and you figure out that the implied expectation is not the same as what actually happens. So it's not like this edge is just always sitting there. To me, this edge matures. It grows as you get closer to expiration. Now, another important point to make here too is that the reason that implied volatility always overstates is because of black swan events. Black swans are wonderful market-driven forces that we will always be up against. We will always be either in a black swan event or another black swan event will be coming. The market crash that happened at the beginning of 2020 this year, that was a black swan event. So if you survived that and you lived through it, congratulations. You just lived through and survived your first black swan events. But they happen all the time, and they don't always happen in broad markets. They can happen in individual securities or individual sectors. I know a while back, a couple years ago, EWZ, which is the Brazil ETF, crashed overnight 20-25%. That was a black swan event, but it didn't get a lot of publicity like the one right now is for the regular global markets, right? But these black swan events are very important in market pricing because they keep everyone honest, because they keep insurance and premium buying in option contracts steady over time. Because if we never knew, or let's say if we always assumed that a black swan event would never happen again, then we could perfectly predict where prices go on a much better scale, because we never had to worry about a shock to the system. We never had to worry about something going too far, too low, or too high. We could basically assume that the markets were super fair, super efficient. No outside forces would ever interact with the market. But every time that we have an outside force that interacts with the market, we don't know how to price it. And most of the time, we price either too aggressively or too pessimistic. And what I mean by that is we assume that stocks will either go higher than they really do or that they will go lower than they really do. And this happens all the time. And black swan events are the natural check and balance to any market force that allows this premium to continue to exist now and into the future. It's the same reason why in insurance, every time we have a massive Category 5 hurricane, right, all the insurance premiums adjust, because now we go through another series where people don't know, is the next storm right around the corner? Is it, you know, 5 years from now? They don't know. And so insurance overprices this expectation so that if another Category 5 storm happens, it doesn't knock their business out, right? It hurts, but it doesn't knock their business out. So hopefully that answers the question. There's definitely no free lunch in the markets. In order to capture this premium, you have to be patient and you've got to hold the contract from now till expiration. That's what I always think about is, you know, in order to bear the fruits of our labor of option selling, just like a farmer, we've got to plant the seeds and we've got to sit there and let it grow. We've got to watch it and babysit it and take care of it and water it for the next 30, 60 days. And that's the risk. That's the risk that we have to take in order to capture this premium. We know the premium exists. We know that it will grow and mature into something profitable over time with enough occurrences and right risk management, but we have to be patient enough to let that maturity happen over time. So hopefully this helps answer your question. As always, if you want to get your question answered here on the podcast, simply head on over to optionalpha.com/ask and click the big red button in the middle of the screen and leave me a private voicemail. Again, there's no software to download or install. It's very easy to do. These are first come, first serve. So as you ask your questions, we queue them up for the next weekly podcast episode. So let's get into the closing bell segment now, where we're going to discuss a new trade that we're making.
Now, the closing bell. Find out which stocks we're looking at right now, trades we're making, and hear our game plan moving forward.
All right, so new trade that we're making today is actually an adjusting and opening position in SMH. I'm not sure if we actually covered this in one of the previous podcasts, but we might have actually covered SMH as an opening position, but we have currently the April position at the time we're recording this, only about 8 days to go until expiration, and we had sold the 125-130 credit call spread. So that means we sold the 125 strike in SMH and we bought the 130 strike on the call side for a net credit. And this net credit then moved our break-even point effectively out by a dollar. The net credit we collected was around 97 cents. So we're looking at a break-even point on the original position of around 126. Now, the idea behind getting into this position at the time was that we needed bearish exposure in our portfolio. We needed to move the center of our portfolio lower to kind of meet up with the market as stocks continued to go through this bottoming process over the last couple of weeks. And so we were adding a bunch of credit spreads on the call side, knowing full well that if the market rebounded and rallied, we could quickly convert these positions over into neutral iron butterflies. And so today's position that we got into was not only an opening trade, but it was more of an adjusting trade to do exactly what we thought we would need to do if SMH rallied. And so at the time I'm recording this, SMH has rallied up to around 127. So now it's starting to breach our break-even point beyond 126. And so we're going to come back in and we're going to sell, in this case, the 125-120 put spread. Now, I think this one was a really interesting one to use as an example for the podcast, because oftentimes when we do recordings, and I know over the last couple of months, we've done a lot of neutral positions because the market was just very calm. But now the market started to be a little bit more volatile. We like to kind of split these positions up and use more credit spreads and debit spreads in some cases if we need to give ourselves more directional exposure and keep our portfolio balanced. And what I like about doing credit spreads like this initially was that we do have the flexibility to convert these into a neutral position if everything rebounds. So if we don't need the bearish exposure anymore and stocks rebound, which is what they've done right now, then we can convert the position and turn it from a bearish position into a neutral position. So in this case with SMH, we're selling the opposing credit put spread. Our original contracts were the 125-130 call spread. So it was a $5 wide spread on the call side. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to mirror that and make it symmetrical on the put side so that it adds no additional margin to our portfolio. So we don't want to increase our margin. We've already covered a lot of the margin with the initial position. So all this is doing, so long as we keep the number of contracts and the spread width the same, is adding additional credit, which reduces risk if SMH continues to move higher. And so that's the assumption we're going on right now, because it's been on a little bit of a rally. We don't know where it's going to stop or when it's going to stop, but with 8 days to go until expiration, we definitely don't want to be left with a position that we had an opportunity to adjust later in the cycle. And in this case, we have an opportunity to adjust this position and reduce risk significantly. So with this SMH position that we're adding, we're selling the 125-120 put spread. And what that does is gives us an additional credit of $111. Now, our original position had a credit of $97. So we've taken our total credit from 97 all the way up to 208. And so with a $5 wide spread, effectively, we've reduced risk by $200 in this position. And that's really good, because if SMH continues to go higher, which we have no control over, then I would much rather have a position that has reduced the amount of loss by $200 or given me an opportunity to potentially make a little bit of money if we see the stock move back into a range, than to do nothing at all and sit on my hands. Now, the other great thing about doing an adjustment like this is that it moves the break-even point out by the amount of the credit that you added. So in our original position, we had the 125 call and the 130 call, and our credit was 97 cents. So effectively, our break-even was around 126. It wasn't exactly 126, but it was around 126. By adding this new credit of $111, our total credit is now 208, which moves our break-even point out on the call side up to 127. So that 127 break-even price is now effectively where SMH is trading. So by making this adjustment to the position, I've moved the break-even point out to potentially give me a better opportunity to make money if SMH stalls here or maybe goes through a little bit of a reverse. And if SMH continues to move higher, then I've reduced the amount of risk by $200 in this position. To me, this is the best that you can do on things like this. We don't know what the market's going to do. We can't control where SMH is going to go. SMH could go back the other direction, but at least at this point, with 8 days to go, we have to do something to start to reduce risk and to start to hedge our position in case SMH does continue to move higher from here. So again, what we're doing here is we're opening up the credit put spread at the 125-120 strike and selling two of those contracts, $5 wide, making it very symmetrical. This adds no additional margin to our portfolio. And in my case, it helps balance out a lot of the other existing positions that we have.
Thanks for listening to the Option Alpha podcast. If you liked what you heard, please drop by iTunes and leave a rating or comment. Plus, you can get everything. Free email updates for future shows, transcripts, video tutorials, case studies, and more. Just visit our website at optionalpha.com.
All right, so that's a wrap for this week's podcast episode here at Option Alpha. But before you go, as always, let's keep the conversation going. Please connect with me on your favorite social media platform. Let me know what questions you have, ideas, thoughts that came to mind after listening to today's show on index options. And I also want to let you know what we've got coming up and what we've been working on. Next week on the podcast, we're going to talk about box spreads. Oh yes, a strategy that we've actually never fully discussed on the show, but we're going to dedicate an entire episode to box spread basics. So if you have any questions on that or any topics that you want us to cover, please get those into me ASAP so that we can add them to the show content. The other thing is we have a pro member onboarding webinar starting on the 29th. That's next week on the 29th, Wednesday at 9 p.m. So if you can make that and you're a pro member, it's a great opportunity to get the high level kind of 10,000 foot view on how we build portfolios, how I think about running an options trading business, the systems and the mechanics that we use around this. So hopefully you can join us on that. As always, I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode and got at least one thing out of it that you can apply right now to help you consistently play smarter, more profitable trades. Until next time, happy trading.